The next topic I wanted to discuss is visual debugging. Oh, this is actually the PDF highlighter. Patrick already had a talk about his visual debugging stuff for LaTeX, and actually what he started by saying that it looks a bit like what the context visual highlighting did, but to be more precise, it looks a bit like what the Mark II highlighter does. So 50 years ago, when you look at the text source, you have absolutely no clue what goes on there. What's happening there? I wanted a bit more feedback on what things happen if you do this. And you skip and you put something in a box and things like that. No clue what it actually does. I tried to figure out a way to visualize boxes, curves, glue, etc. This is the one that you referred to. And at some point, I found out, and this is something, there are some things in tech that if you don't try it, you don't know it's there. I said, and I think it started with Kern. If I have a Kern, if I want to visualize it, I should just, if I want to make it really visible, I should put a rule there, with the width of this Kern, and then, I should go back over this width and put the kern there, something like that. Or I can simply replace the kern by this rule in many cases. They say, how do I do that? Well, I have to redefine kern, the primitive kern. Okay, works okay. And then I said, how do I do it with boxes? I put something around the box, rules. Yeah. I have to redefine HBox. Surprise, I can redefine HBox. And by doing that, I found out that my document still ran. And this is something, it's not natural that you think, you probably agree with that you can redefine a primitive like that. But as long as you don't unbox, you're pretty safe in replacing it by something else. So in Mark II, one of the first thing I did in tech and also showed in presentation was this kind of visualizing. And unfortunately, I couldn't find back the booklet that I handed out at the meeting at that time. Somehow, I think I didn't store stuff that time. There were a couple of tricky things, if you think about that. Stretch. There was no way, if you have a skip, to figure out the stretch, apart from using the skip. And then, more or less, splitting off the minus plus part by some juggling of tokens. Leaders, another thing that gets repeated. Right? The old-fashioned table of contents with all these dots between the title and the page number. And there was no ETEG yet. But eventually I met. So I gave some presentations. It was nice to see the puzzled faces of experts. I still see thing of Piet van Oostrom sitting on the front row. Well, Piet knows way more about tech than any of us, I think. And it's looking like something is wrong here. Yeah, you cannot redefine an HBox. Okay, I could. Somehow, it could be done. As I mentioned, it's somewhat interfering. There's when you don't enable this kind of memory, if you don't redefine a primitive, there's no overhead. But it is a bit awkward. You need to make sure that if a user enables a mechanism like this, that the iPlace where you do the unboxing and whatever, that is turned off. So if you look at the context code, the Mark II context code, there are several places where this mechanism is turned off. So when I was redoing most of the Mark IV code, I was looking at it, I don't like that. I don't want this kind of weird commands there that turn things off, that users seldom turn on. And I said, well, okay, this is visual debugging code. Is anybody actually using this? Because I wasn't using it myself. Yeah. It's sometimes funny to see what happens, but it was not really a big user.
Well, at the time, I used it a lot. Because I was writing this XSL formatter engine that was interpreting XSL faux and converting that into context. And because faux is such a dodgy thing to handle, I used the visualizer quite a lot to see what actually was going on.
Because you have lots of boxes and margins and things like that.
Yeah, all these paddings and the frames. Yeah.
And basically the cornerstone of that kind of debugging is the what we called in context the ruled HBox command. And the ruled HBox command I actually use a lot. Like, oh, I have an HBox, I want to see exactly what the bounding box is basically. I change slash HBox into slash ruled HBox and I see what's there. So, okay, there's something, some funny space in there or whatever, need to fix it. So some of the helpers are quite handy. That means that if I do a rewrite and I have ended up at the support modules of context, that well, either I kick it out or I rewrite it. But if I need part of it, I can as well rewrite it, because I already had done some experience in experiments in how I would like to rewrite it long ago. And this is why we redid it. So. Before I show that, a few more words on debugging. In Mark IV, we have way more debugging information available because there's so much code now of action happening at the Lua end. That's actually easier to add more tracing code. There's a lot of additional tracing code available. But at the same time, when we Taco and I are developing this engine, especially in the beginning, you say, okay, what's happening there, and you try to visualize things. So there's a lot of additional visualization modules for fonts and masks and metapose stuff and graphics and characters and things like that. Some of that I think makes sense to keep, so I will turn it into general modules so that people can more easily see all the kinds of things that happen in LuaTeX. Some of that is actually distributed, but not really as a usable module. There are some debugging aids in Mark II. Some of them really make no sense at all anymore, like tracing UTF-8, not needed, everything is UTF-8. Tracing encodings, tracing remappings and all kinds of other stuff, forget about it. So as I already said, I will normalize all these things in due time. Okay, I already mentioned to go back to the visual debugger, to clean it up, keep that thing, and it's actually the starting point for more of this debugging stuff. Now the thing is, as I told before, redefining primitives has side effects. So redefining primitives is not the way to go. This is I already figured that out long ago, that in many cases doing it the Lua way is providing a solution that doesn't interfere. You know, you operate on a node list and you do that at the moment where Kev already has done all its parsing, and anything that can interfere you will try to avoid. I had a lot of Lua helper code, so actually redoing it would be no big deal. Old code is still there as a module, in case anybody is interested in it. So, to summarize how it works, in Mark II I overloaded the primitives. Yeah, so every sensible indirect, HBox, VBox, whatever, became a macro. And I used rules, mostly to visualize all the things. There are a couple of things, like if you skip, you visualize, skip, you have to go back, so you have to compensate code. That was an important property. However, in Mark 4, done completely different. A lot of code actually was already in place, which means that it was not so hard to write a mechanism that basically just as what Patrick was telling a few days ago, you run over the node list and do things with the node list, and then inject visualize, although here we do it a different way. First of all, we use colors. I use a couple of rules here and there, and there is some additional text injected that gives some information about what happens. Another property is you have control over what gets visualized. So you can say, I only want to show the boxes, I only want to show the curves, I only want to show whatever. And this is actually the fun part, you have control over what gets shown by using layers. Thinking of this, Marco, I had a poster that should have. And this, I think, probably also the stuff that can. Yeah, one of these posters. I've made a very big example where we'll put it on the wall, where you can look actually about what has happened, because it's. So, when writing this kind of code, in most cases, the time didn't go in figuring out how to do it, but in how to visualize things in such a way, because if you has anybody of you ever seen this? I'm not sure. Oh, I don't have internet access. If you go into, it's Firefox, I think, there is a relatively new tracing option in the bottom end and somewhere, and it says 3D. Does anybody know it? If you click on the 3D, you suddenly end up in a 3D model of your web page, and you can see the stacking of the CSS. Some sites are really weird. They have, you know, it looks like they have 20 layers of stacking. Do you have Firefox here? In show page and things like that. It's in the tracing stuff. I can probably show you later. And the same thing applies, of course, to that document. If you box and box and box and box, you have 20 levels of boxing, and a lot of visualization got lost because it's on top of each other. Yeah? And even if you put some yeah, so if you have this is the poster of the Context Conference. Every year I make a poster. This is the poster of Context Conference. So this is boxed.
Yeah. It's actually the first time that anybody besides Hans sees it.
I sent you a copy.
Yeah, you sent me a copy, but I didn't open the attachment because I was too busy.
Okay, let's imagine that it was on the website. Yeah.
Or shown here somewhere in Breskens, like at the door.
Could be. So what you see here is, and I'll show you on screen later, but this is nicer, cooler. So there's a box there. Maybe you can see this thin line, and then actually see your four boxes on top of each other. So how do you visualize this kind of stuff? And that's where normally the time goes. There were a couple of side effects because some of the visualizations, they interfere a little bit with the hard-coded expectations. I always say that the backend. The root at backend currently, to a large extent, is the PDF dev backend. And there are some things in there. You know, if you inject a rule in a node list, and you do it at a place where the backend doesn't expect it, and has some kind of shortcut, oh, I only expect glyphs here, you will never see that rule, because the backend thinks it's only seeing glyphs. The backend is not generic, so to say. It has some ideas about what it can expect. Actually, this is also the case at the front end. Sometimes you can do things, but if that really thinks it's not doing the thing that you think it's doing, it can easily skip over nodes that it doesn't expect at that moment. I think, for instance, there are some hard code expectations about what's the first node in the list. If at the tech end it's impossible to get, let's say, a rule at the beginning of a list, then why should the back end look at a rule at the beginning of a list? Okay, so this is the basic stuff. PDF stores. There's another one in the wrong directory. Well, I can best open the document. Okay, this is the file, yeah. So this is the, just to show you. This has a lot of information, yeah. There's a bounding box of the W. There's a little bit of negative kerning here between the W and the E. Yeah. There's some horizontal spacing or whatever going on. There's an H box there. So you say, okay, how can I find out this mess? So let's get rid of most of it. And let's keep the glyphs. So these are the glyphs. And the glyphs have bounding boxes. Yeah. Let's visualize the boxes. Okay, these are all the boxes around. Yeah, so you suddenly see the boxes. Currents. Okay, let's get rid of the boxes and see only the currents.
The layers.
This is layers. Yeah, this PDF layer.
Is
layers.
It a standard for the reader?
Mm-hmm.
It's yeah.
We don't see some currents.
Hmm? Yeah, but these are not the font currents. Font currents are different things. I actually haven't enabled the font currents yet. Font currents is a different matter. Yeah, that's one of the other things that you can. And Latin Modern has lots of currents, but there are quite some fonts out there that don't have currents. Lucida doesn't have any currents.
Mm-hmm. Intentionally.
Yeah, it's just designed to be kernless. So
no, it's designed to be used by an optimal typesetter that does the kerning all magically itself.
Yes,
I think.
Maybe. Because even in the new version, they didn't add the kerns.
They don't believe in kerns.
Have you ever seen
Seriously.
A kern? What is the color of kern?
Ah, you can see.
Oh my
goodness.
No.
Yes, so this visualizer, this thing, provides the information on layers and can be handy to say I want to see this or I don't want to see this. And
yeah.
This is a big difference between the old visual debugger and this one. The other is that I don't no longer use any kind of funny characters or whatever to like some kind of visualization. I just want to see that this is a horizontal skip. Okay, it's hard to see in this case that it had a certain ridge, but this is a torture test, not so much an real example, because normally you will apply this kind of stuff on smaller documents. Let's see if we can find some smaller documents. I had for some reason it looked like I've overwritten my. Okay, I have to start new with a new document. I think I've overwritten my test file. Oh wait a minute, there's maybe some, yeah, there are some couple pages here that make sense. Okay. I can do some real examples later. So you saw the big thing, the big complex thing, this one, it makes sense to walk it, look at it. So here is an example. So this is the bounding box. Okay, this is actually already a difference between, for instance, Latin Modern and all the fonts, other fonts, and Tech, the traditional Tech fonts, which have this limited number of heights and depths. Yeah, so just to mention a couple of the things that you run into. Okay, you want to see the baseline. In many cases, in a box, the only reason why I want to see the box is, of course, because of fuzzy spacing, but also because I want to see where the baseline sits. So here you have the baseline. This is one line. At some point, you need a kind of threshold that you start making into a dashed line. So that's adding a couple of lines of code to do that kind of stuff. you see a box, ruled H box, so now I show that you still have the low level commands, ruled H box, take boxes. Yeah? There's no base, there's a baseline of course, but there's no depths here. Here I added the character with some depths, so suddenly we get some depths. Yeah? And again, this is I use transparencies on top. So because I use transparencies, you can still to some extent see what is below. I found out that it's very annoying that stuff got on the screen, it looks better than in print, of course. You get a horizontal space. In this case, it's covered. There's a mode that you can reverse it. Show makeup, and that's now it gets hairy. Show makeup does everything. Show makeup is sort of like, okay, I want to show all the visual things. Okay, fine. Show makeup, H box. So the H box automatically, it somehow becomes a visual H box. This is done using assigning attributes and things like that. So we can have a nested thing. As you see, ruled H box, ruled feed box, ruled feed top. You still see one frame because they're all on top of each other. Show makeup provides a little bit more information. Show makeup, H box, shows an H box here. So an H box, but it also tags it as an H box. So you see that it's an H box. I add a V box. So V ends up there. So this is the kind of stuff that putting that on top of it doesn't work. So now I know that at least that there is an H box and a V box. V top, yeah. So there is also a V top. Now, if you know something about the internals of text, then you also know that internally, once you have done this VTOP, it's absolutely unknown in tech, in the note list or whatever, that it is a VTOP. This information is gone. But nevertheless, you can figure out that it is one. Yeah? A completely different sort of visualization. Show struts. You can visualize struts. Again, this is non-intrusive way of doing it. You can visualize glyphs, show glyphs. So you see the. Here I go from right to left in the middle of this sentence. Yeah, you can see that. Glyphs, I can see the what's it there. This is dir mode. So if you're doing bidirectional typesetting, it makes sense sometimes to keep track of where these direction changing nodes end up. It is debatable if it should up at the left and the right.
It's sort of confusing. I'm thinking it should be on the left.
It should be on the left somehow, yeah.
For better debugging. Yeah. But I'm not sure.
Yeah. The whole thing with, you know, there are some things with this left, right, with the nodes that we still have to sort out if it comes out to symmetry, yeah, on the whole line. We have always one left, always one right. Maybe then it becomes a different picture also. Now, what you see here is that this is actually implemented in context as a tracker. All this kind of stuff is implemented as trackers. So I have a tracker visualizer, what's it? So I can have a tracker visualizer, glyphs, visualizer, H-box, visualizer, V-box. Or it can become a separated list. This means that as I do this at the tech end and not at the Lua end, it has to know that this range of glyphs has to be visualized, if it has to be, or that this range of this H box is an H box. No, it's not even H box. This piece of the paragraph has to show the what's it. Yeah. So what happens here is that basically nothing happens apart from the fact that the state of nodes from that point on get some kind of way, get in one way or the other signaled. And I do that by using attributes. So there's an attribute set that's carried along with the this. And this is why I can do this in a basically non-intrusive way, because attributes are non-intrusive. So this is one part of visual debugging. There's another thing I wanted to show. I probably still have time.
Nearly half an hour.
Somehow some of the files I had, I can find them anymore. Okay. I have to search up a file. As I mentioned, there are a couple of mechanisms that when you develop a system like LuaTeX Context, whatever, that sometimes you really want to know what's going on. Currently, tomorrow there will be a talk about Devanagari, and Kai wrote a lot of code for that, and I'm currently integrating that and cleaning it up, speeding it up, whatever. And in the process, you need to know what happens with open type, in this case, open type fonts. So here's another way of tracking. Some of you might have seen this already. Yeah. And again, we use colors for showing the things. It's very hard to see, probably. Yeah, you see that this has a dark magenta color. That's because we have only a limited set of useful colors that we can use for this. But again, this is a way of a mix of visual debugging and tracing. Yeah, you have a feature set, and you apply it to some kind to some sequence of input, and then these thingies get parsed in one of the first passes, and they get properties like, well, are they, in this case, particular properties like, are they vowels that should be swapped or not or whatever. And they're giving it a color, you can at least see that they have undergone some processing. For Arabic, we have similar things. I will show that tomorrow. But you have to apply lots of features and also have this kind of color. So, let's say visual debugging in context not only refers to ruled edge boxes and whatever, but also to anything that somehow can give some visual feedback of how things work. In this case, applying features. And so there's a sort of, this is actually a form of command. You use this module, font, and you just set the variables, you give it a sample, you set what font it is and what feature set, and you can see what features are applied. Basically, you could use it to debug. Because you get stepwise, you can stepwise see what the differences are, yeah, where the ligatures show up and where things like that. And this is actually relatively independent. You need context, but you can have one file where you test this kind of stuff. And these are the easy things, I think there are. Yeah. And especially if you have an error, right, you can see where characters start, where they disappeared or were replaced or were swapped or turns. Okay, so there's more to debugging than this.
It's always the question, where is the error? In font, in font system, or in something else?
Yeah, but by now I'm pretty sure that
in context there is the error.
This machinery is getting okay. pretty okay. There are cases, actually, when doing this, I found out that there was actually a problem. You can have ligatures and ligature components. So if you make an Fi out of an F and an I, we still store the F and the I somewhere in the components part of a glyph. It's a linked list that is part of a glyph. There's a bit of traditional tech stuff where tech had to basically reconstruct the original input stream based on the components of a ligature so that it could rehyphenate again. So this property was kept, and actually it's needed because in Arabic, where you can have vowels on ligatures, you need actually to know on which component of the ligature the vowel goes. So you basically need to be able to reanalyze this ligature. And in Devanagari, there are so many ligatures that you have ligatures of ligatures of ligatures of ligatures that you get a complete stack of components and components and components. And for that, it was quite handy to know, oh, wait a minute, something is really getting lost here or disappearing. And actually, Kai found also for the Arabic part that there was one particular font where they somehow, they misuse a feature or they do something, but something disappears. So I'm not saying that everything is perfect, but at least you can identify the stage where, it goes wrong there or there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that can save you a lot of time. Okay, so I will show a little bit more about it tomorrow. So this is a bit the visual debugging stuff. Are there any questions? No questions. Is there anything, at least today, what you want to hear or not hear? Maybe, then we can quit. But what you want to hear? Yeah?
Maybe the idea what you are doing with the Devanagari, you should try the Adobe Arabic font, which works very nice, but the result is correct only in some Ghost View, Sumatra, but in Acrobat with number higher than 7, it's completely wrong.
You mean Arab type?
Yeah, no, the result, because Arabic has also so many ligatures that never get the same characters as you put in. Yeah.
But do you have an example?
I can find it.
Yeah, if you can find it, I can put it here and can see it. Because Arab type is one of our reference fonts that we use, and I never have had any problems. So what do you use to position it? How do you render it?
I use the ZTEC for the result.
Okay, so maybe there's a bug in ZTEC. Yeah. But so you should have the Arabic snippet, then I can put it in here.
When I sent I had a file with many such Arabic names. When came the proofs from print house, it was wrong. Yeah, in the same way as in Acrobat, higher version. Acrobat 7 works fine.
Mm-hmm.
And when the publisher communicated with the printing house, they say, and the final result, the book was okay. So I don't know what the mistake is. Maybe some mistakes in the font.
Normally, a font is embedded, so that should not happen. The thing is a bit with, with Arabic is it goes the other way around. So there is indeed some skipping in both ways or whatever. But even then, I would say, at the PDF level, it's just a stream of. Well, moves, isn't it? Basically, just moves.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah.
Should be. Yeah. One potential reason for that could be that they didn't ship the font, so that they assumed that it was a system font. If you configure you can configure Acrobat to use system fonts, and there are different versions of Arab type.
But the font was included, so.
Yeah, but even then. Acrobat can be set up to prefer system fonts.
Uh-huh. That's an interesting idea.
The same is true for Cambria. There are versions of Cambria, which is a rather nice mouse font. And sometimes, not so long ago, I got an example from a user. It's completely messed up. And I looked, and I kept looking. And why is it working at my place and why does it? And then he is using an old version or wrong version, but the one with the funny 2000 problem.
I should add that the same result was the Acrobat 10 Pro.
Uh-huh.
completely from.
In 10? I use 10. Yeah. The thing with Arabic is because we have the Husseini font. Yeah, there will be some about it tomorrow. I'll show at least some of the stuff. It's pretty complex. This is three steps of features. The average Arab font easily have 5 or 10 steps of features, and I have examples of 20 steps of features, and still goes right because it's just juggling glyphs and positioning. So, okay, if you have examples, I can run them.
Do you like also the text source?
No, I just need the Arabic piece. The bit. If you have the Arabic piece on a stick, I can put it here and see. More questions? Okay.
What about XML?
You want to know something about XML? Okay, nobody asked. I can tell something about XML.
In 20 minutes.
In 20 minutes, yeah. So the people not interested then can leave. Now the thing is XML, I've talked about XML so many times that, well, I wasn't sure if anybody was interested in that kind of stuff. Let's see. Let's first close down a lot of. This is actually another module that has been rewritten recently, the UNIS module. Yeah? We used to have a UNIS subsystem. What we did is, you know, there's MAS, but now we are going to slowly build up a set of physics modules, chemistry modules, whatever. So this used to be something like this. Yeah? And you got it properly done. Now it's a complete interpreter, so now you get, automatically you get think like this, if you enter think like this. So this is another module that is new, I forgot to tell about it, okay. XML. How many of you have been using, if you are a context user anyway, the XML stuff? Looked in it, nobody? Or okay, so it's a bit of it is known. Most of my work, my daily work, involves XML. So I get XML and have to process it. And it's probably one of the reasons why I'm still using Tech, because well, nobody asked me to do two types of Tech documents, and nobody is interested in Tech input, so. That's not to say that most of what we produce is XML, is not really high quality stuff or whatever, but it's in many cases very complex stuff. Now, in Mark II, we had a so called. We had a so called streaming parser. And a streaming parser, if you look at this, for instance, this piece of XML, yeah, the streaming parser, it sees something and it does something with something. Yeah? It sees what and it does something with what. So it goes through the document. You can, of course, write mechanisms and say, okay, I see something, I pick up anything that is in something, so I pick up anything here, and I do something with the here. That's another. It's still streaming, yeah. You have trigger point basically. You see an element, the beginning of an element, and you start doing something with this element. It also means that you basically go top down in your document. Well, top down is not entirely correct in terms of tree, but basically you work top down.
Over the leaves. You walk to leaves, probably.
Yeah, you walk to leaves, but even there, these are two kits of something. and you see them one after the other.
Yeah, that's of course that's the problem.
Yeah, so if you want to do something with ever before what,
you should know if it's correct as regard to the schema.
Yeah, but say that
if the order is correct, for example.
Yeah, and if the schema is very liberal and says what and ever may be in any order, and you want to do something with ever first, you need to store what, do something with ever, and then do something with what. Yeah. So it's a bit, from the tech perspective, a bit messy that you have to store stuff because you don't want to store stuff in tech. In Contact Mark 4, we have a tree-based approach. And if you try to, probably not easy for all of you, but if you try to imagine what happens with a tech tree in Mark 4, it's, even for me, it's somewhat mind-boggling in terms of what happens there. Think of this. You load this XML, basically text. It's turned into a tree. So now we have a tree, as you mentioned. So we have something, which have the two leaves, yeah? What and ever. There's still nothing done with it. And then, when I've loaded it, I start serializing the thing to tech. I just basically push the whole thing to tech. But when doing that, every time I see one of these nodes, something or what or ever, I apply something to it, a setup. Here you see an example of setups. Later I give an example of how you can do that yourself. So tech, just imagine I'm tech. I see this tree coming my way, and all these leaves have something associated, and they can expand into something else, and do something else, and do something else, and everything eventually might return in something printed to my tech stomach, so to say, because that's terminology. So it basically becomes one big expansion. If you know about tech and expansion, yeah, macros, expanding into other macros, and whatever, you basically have a sort of explosion of things resulting in input in tech, which is then processed. That's at least one way of looking at it. If Paco and I would discuss it, we say you have input and input and input and then a multi-nested input stack, which is, well, always a bit difficult to imagine in tech. Okay, but let's see how this works. In this case, I use a buffer because then you can see the XML file and as well as what happens with it. So this is the XML snippet. What I do is it, I process it. Yeah. So start text, XML process buffer in this case. This is the name of the buffer. Test. And I give it a name. So whatever I process here gets the name main. Forget about this optional argument here. So how does it know what has to be done with something, or what, or ever? Well, I define what in context is called a setup. Setups are used for several things, and among the things are XML, and then they are called XML setups. And this one is called XML something. Yeah? Okay, we have something here, and XML something does something here. And it only shows, basically, the something. Yeah, I can run it, and you can see that. Yeah, it shows the something. Yeah, which is what you expect. So how does it know that it has to do this particular thing with something? Then we go back one step. Yeah, we have another setup. My setups, yeah. And this one, actually I can make this simpler, so it's easier. This one maps something onto HTML, and the star means whatever it matched. I can simplify this, I can say this, yeah. Even more general, I can say any element that you see should be mapped on
setup
XML some whatever the name was. And then I need one more step, and this step said register this action, and there can be a whole list of things here, yeah, because maybe I want to map some things differently, but let's keep it simple. This is the only thing I want to do in this setup. I register as something that needs to be applied to every XML file or whatever thing I see. Now there's one thing here, the hash one here is basically this one. So I can apply basically to the different trees or different nodes if I give them different names. So this is sort of an abstraction of the node where you are. So I process this thing, it sees something. Yeah, it's basically matched, you can say here. It's already matched, but let's assume it get matched. This one is then executed. This is the something, because this has become this node. And I ask it to show something, and it will show something. Okay, say that you want to do more than showing it. We want to basically typeset it. Another one, XML flush. And you see, nothing happens. We still get the same output. That is because nothing is known to do with what and ever. So we're going to associate a setup with what? And now we get test one, and test one is the text indeed in what? Yeah.
What happens to the ID?
Nothing yet. It's just ID is an attribute, and I'll show that later. Okay, ever, we also want to flush it, and we want it to be bold. So we flush it, and we get something bold. So again, what happens here is, at some point when I process this, this is one way of processing, when I process this, process buffer, it starts by piping stuff to tech, and it does so by applying setups. The first thing it sees, the root, is something, it sees something, it flushes it. When it flushes it, it says, oh wait a minute, I have to serialize what? What? Flushes itself. I serialize after that ever. Oh, oops, I have to go to boldface, flush myself, and finish with that. And basically, the tree is not large, I'm done then. Yeah, so this all gets basically expanded into something and printed to death.
It's still linear, there is no way to change the.
Yeah, probably we will come to that. Yeah.
Oh.
Because.
I would like to flush everything. Would XML star work for every element?
No, because I haven't defined. You can define a default behavior. You can say, I want everything to be flushed, of course. If you can actually, to do the stupid way, you can do this. You can then define a flush, and then everything gets flushed.
Ah, so that's the command, that's not the name of the element.
No, this is the setup. But you can define the setup flush. Now everything gets flushed. Yeah, it can be anything. I use the same name because it's easier, but it can be any name. Yeah. But let's for the moment stick to this name. Okay. Now the thing is, as you saw, because you ask still about the order, you saw this with a show, I actually have access to this particular node. So say that I don't do this, let's keep this one, that I don't do a flush here, but that I want to only have what? One is what? Yeah. But say that I now want to reverse the order. So now I get ever first before what? Yeah. So at this point, I can do with this basically subtree anything I want. It's, you know, it's not sequentially done. It's because I asked to flush, it will flush everything, and then it will of course flush in the order that that is defined. But if I do something different, maybe I'm completely uninterested in ever or in what or in.
If you have a sequence, an ordered sequence there, and within the tree, within one element, an ordered sequence of same elements.
Yeah, you want more. You can do. All.
Say you have a table.
Okay, we can
a
define.
A table, and you have rows of a table, contents of rows of tables.
Okay,
say
that you.
Describe in an XML file.
Yeah, so you have something like this. You want to typeset that as a table. Okay, there we go. We basically already have most of the elements mapped because of this rule. Yeah. That's the outer level. A table is a table. Yeah? A row is a row. A cell is a cell. Oh, I've forgotten something. Table, TRTD, I think we are making an error somewhere. Table. Okay, I see it. Tommy, we have to because we don't flush everything here, yeah. Because we are doing explicit flushes. So let's just comment this one. So it doesn't sit in the way. Yeah, so okay. So now I have a table. Yeah? So what happens? I could do the flush here, but it's an example of being explicit. Yeah? Table, I flush all rows, but I could also do this. Because there are only rows here. This should work too. Yeah.
We are out of time.
Yeah, okay. Five minutes?
Not really. No. 5 seconds, man. 3, 2, 1. Maybe we can continue some more.
But, well, let's see. You see the picture?
Yeah.
Yes.
One more question I was going to ask is that you do the parsing on all the tags. Only tag parses.
The XML parse is completely written in Lua.
And Lua. So nothing there. So it's okay.
And even this is, you see, I call for these, and it supports an XPub-like syntax. So I can even say, give me only the first or the last row or whatever. It's complete XML, basically XPass, but I call it LPass because there's some specific things for tag in it. Parse it too, also in Lua. And it's, to be honest, it's the XML parse is really, really fast and can handle lots of data. That's a nice thing. It's all there, just like the SQL. The SQL loses the library, but the XML is embedded because I need it.
It works on the, if you want to get some element chosen somewhere in there, as you're using the buffer and getting it out of the buffer, and you can probably get
the tree is completely loaded in memory. I have the complete tree.
Mm-hmm.
So I can, you can say, you can have a table of contents. You can say, I make it by writing chapter title to file, but you can also say now I just filter all the table of content entries from the tree.
Okay, so you keep it.
It's there. Yeah, it's
all the time.
It's all the time there, and not sequential, but top down.
You could also the other approach is you could make it in a sequence of commands, tech commands. Having arguments. The problem is with many arguments.
That's Mark 2 and it becomes bits and slow and whatever. This is way faster.
Hans, thank you very much.
Yeah.